Blind Nil Audio.
Today on 50 Fires is my conversation with my friend Josh Brown.
We weren't rich, but like if I needed a jacket for school, I told my mom I need a jacket and I had one the next day and I never thought about it. And it turns out it was harder than it looked.
Now I know many of you have heard of Josh. You've seen him on CNBC, you've heard him on his podcast, or maybe you've read one of his books. But today, you're going to hear stories he hasn't told anywhere else.
What do I do with that now? I don't know what to do with it.
That's coming up today on 50 Fires. Greetings, it's Carl. Today, my guest on 50 Fires is Josh Brown. I'm so excited to share this conversation with you. I've known Josh for a very long time. Josh's work has been seen everywhere. Yahoo Finance, Business Insider, CNBC, The Wall Street Journal. And he also co-hosts a weekly podcast with Michael Batnick called The Compound and Friends. Josh and I first met years ago. And while the memory is fuzzy, the thing I remember is being in a small office in a large building in a huge city, New York, sitting across the table from somebody who was incredibly excited and animated about the difference they wanted to make in the world. And I remember thinking that although we come from very different backgrounds, you know, I grew up a kid from the hills in Utah, and Josh grew up just outside of New York City. I remember thinking, it's going to be super fun to watch what downtown Josh Brown does with his career. So let's get into it. I'm Carl Richards, an author, artist, and proud financial planner. And today we're talking about money with Josh Brown. This is 50 Fires, a podcast about money and meaning.
How do I talk into a microphone? Can you guys instruct me?
Is this thing on? Hello, hello.
So good to see you, Carl. How are you, man?
I'm great. Yeah, things are really good.
Good.
Tell me, it'd be fun to just back up. I've never had this conversation with you. What's your earliest memory of money?
My earliest memory of money was I had a rich uncle and I was in sleepaway camp. And this is 1987. I'm 10 years old. And before I leave for camp, my uncle, I guess a couple of months before, it was my birthday, my 10th birthday. And my uncle gave me $100 in singles, but like freshly minted from the bank, like brand new, like crease free, perfect $1 bills in a band, 100 of them. And I was just like blown away by that because I never like had that much money at once. $100 in 1987 was a lot of money. And the fact that it was in singles and it was like so physical, it was like, I don't want to call it a brick, but like if you dropped it, it made a sound. Right. So like an idiot, I brought it with me to summer camp, and the counselors would go to the general store. You have to keep in mind, in summer camp, you're drinking like water or basically juice that they make themselves, and that's it. So the counselors would come back and sell Coke and Pepsi, Coca-Cola and Pepsi. They would sell cans of soda for, you know, $3. And this is when a soda was 25 cents. So I would reach into my stack, I thought surreptitiously, and take a $1 bill or $2 or $3. And I would pay the counselor, who was a teenager, for the soda. And everyone would see where I was keeping it. And eventually the whole thing was gone. So somebody took it.
How long? Oh, somebody took it. Oh.
Yeah. I probably lasted a week. So then my parents came up 3 weeks into camp for visiting day. And for whatever reason, they like knew I brought it with me, or maybe like it was a big deal. It sounds ridiculous now, but back then $100 in the hands of a 10-year-old was like a really big deal. It's probably like $1,000 now.
For sure.
So they're like, where's the money? And I just remember hysterically crying and admitting to them that I lost it or it was stolen. I have no idea. I don't know what happened. But that was not just a money memory. It was the first time, because nobody had ever stolen anything from me up until that point. Like I never had my bike stolen. I never had a toy taken. So it's the first time I think I ever like saw, I don't want to say human nature, but like that facet of human nature, and was like really, really aware from that point forward what people were capable of. because at the time that felt like the end of the world to me. And that's probably the oldest memory I have of something to do with money in my life.
Wild.
What do I do with that now? What? I don't know what to do with it.
I know. I was just going to ask you, like, actually, I've got two questions. One of my favorite things to ask is, like, can you remember holding the first time you held a sum of money in your hands? And you've, like, already answered. I'm curious, can you remember, like, the feeling of that?
Yeah. Oh, I had, like, the joke is I had, like, a toy lockbox, and that's where I was keeping it. So somebody was able to, like, click that thing open, like a tin little lockbox with a combination. Right. But apparently that you know, I still had that. It just didn't have anything in it.
Right. What do you make of that now, looking back on it?
I don't know. It's really the first time I've thought about it, probably in 35 years, you bring it up. I haven't really – it's not, like, something that I've ever thought about since it happened. But that's definitely my earliest memory. Now, you know what, though? People have taken things from me since. People have tried to use money in different ways, you know, as bait, as a weapon, as, like, a way to curry favor. People have tried to use money to get themselves into my life. So, like, not at this point, nothing really shocks me about, you know, the way money can be used by people, and what it can do and the power that it holds over us. So I just think that's, like, one more story of, oh, that's a really quick way to find out that you're around someone that's either desperate or immoral. Keep $100 under your bed in a tin lockbox. Like, you'll find out real quick. So it's hard for me to be shocked at this point.
Yeah, that idea of power over us is super fascinating, right? Like, this, the power of money. And I'm curious, just staying back in childhood, like, what was money like growing up in your house?
We were fine. I would say we were probably upper middle class. For where we lived, We were probably regular middle class. But I grew up in Nassau County, which is on Long Island. It's one of the wealthiest counties in America. And I probably had a lot of resources and advantages that most people didn't have. And of course, didn't really appreciate it in the moment. Because everyone around me looked just like me. And, you know, we were pretty sheltered from the real world and real struggles and hardship. So years later, my father had told me some things that he had to compromise and give up along the way in order to keep that going. We never had any lapse in our childhood. Like, if, you know, if we asked for a toy for Christmas, we probably got it, or Hanukkah. I celebrated both. Like, we never really had a moment of hardship, and that's probably because our parents did a good job of just, like, not sharing that with us. So, but like everyone else, they had times when they were up, times when they were down, but we never felt the effects of that. And that's one of the things that I look back and think about. And then subsequently, like, years later, I would hear stories of, do you have any idea who I had to borrow money from so that you could go to the college you wanted to go to? Like, you know, I didn't hear that stuff until I was in my 30s.
Wow.
But I do think a lot of kids grow up and, I mean, it's not a cliche. It's true. They may not experience those ups and downs, you know, that a lot of kids experience. Like, there are kids that grow up and they think, like, things are just good, or things are okay to them. They don't think they're good. They think it's like, oh, this is just normal life. And they don't necessarily understand the things that had to happen behind the scenes in order to preserve that image and that feeling. Like, don't worry, we're fine. Everything's okay. So I do think about that from time to time. Like, what are the things that I have to do that I don't necessarily, like, share every detail of how hard I work with my kids? If anything, I try to make things look easy and fun because I don't want them to dread becoming providers someday.
Did you really have no sense of that? Or do you remember feeling you just, like, no sense of the struggle?
No. We weren't rich, but, like, if I needed a jacket for school, I told my mom I need a jacket, and I had one the next day, and I never thought about it. And it turns out it was harder than it looked.
Tell me about learning about that. Like, so you said in your 30s?
Yeah, like, years later, it would be like, oh, you take for granted what we did for you. And I'm like, every parent says that. No. Like, you really don't understand. In order to allow you to do everything that we had always allowed you to do and keep that going, there were a lot of things behind the scenes that had to happen that we just didn't burden you with. So that was interesting to learn about.
I mean, when you learned that, were you glad you didn't know?
Yeah.
Which has led to your desire to, like, use the word fun and easy.
Well, I got, yeah, I'm doing the same thing. Like, I have hard times, good times, like everyone else. I have ups and downs. You know, I'm still working harder than I've ever worked. I might have more money now. I might have more success. But for me to do the things that I want to be able to do professionally, I have to keep going. I started working and never stopped. Like, I've never had a gap in between, you know. But like, I don't come home and like lay it out for my kids, like everyone that disappointed me and everything I screwed up and, you know, how hard this meeting was or this particular thing that went wrong. Mm. I really don't want that to be part of the dialogue with my family if I can help it. I mean, I can't completely avoid coming home in a bad mood.
Right, right.
But I do think that that's like something that I'm trying to do, is just never give my kids even a whiff of insecurity at all. I just don't want them to have that. I work too hard for them to have that. So I do try very much to leave that at work if I can.
Hey, it's Carl. So this is really interesting to me because I'm not sure exactly how I feel at this idea of sheltering the kids from the ups and downs of the family's finances. I know in the past I felt exactly the way Josh is talking about here. In fact, I remember when we had a really tough time financially when we were living in Las Vegas, I would rush home after work to make sure I got the mail before anybody else, especially the kids, saw it, right? Mail from the bank, mail from creditors. I would rush home to get it because I was protecting them because I thought that was my job. And years later, I've had conversations with my kids where it was clear they knew something was going on anyway. And it actually was a little, they told me, it was a little harder not knowing what it was because they could feel it in the air. So I don't know what the right answer is. I just know that we need to figure out how to talk about money more. So I found it frankly comforting that Josh said this is something he thinks a lot about too. Where did you start learning about money? Like, did you have conversations with your parents about it? Like, were there allowance or budgets, or was that something that happened in school or never?
No, it really wasn't until I was working that I had even given it a second thought. And my wife was my girlfriend in high school.
Wow.
And we went to separate colleges, and then we got back together in our 20s. And she is an accountant's daughter. And he is an incredible person. And he really imparted in her this really deeply felt sense of responsibility. And she is relentlessly interested in like the mundane details of things like what kind of credit card should we get and what's the best way to do this. And like she goes out in search of advantages and making smart financial decisions. I have like zero interest in that. I'm a creative. I think big. I'm not trying to save a dollar. I'm trying to like make $1 million. And we just have completely different personalities. But I think we work really well together for that reason. Mm. Because I could not do what I do and spend my days the way I spend my days if there weren't a partner on the other side of this whole mess who's like actually paying attention to the details and organizing us. And so we're a really great partnership. She understands my limitations, and I get a lot of benefit out of allowing her to decide and organize our personal finances. It frees me up to be more of myself. And, you know, we've been together on and off since 1993, and we got married in 2003. So we've had a long run together, and I think we work really well together.
What, tell me about, I mean, maybe you guys are different. Maybe you don't argue about money.
Well, we have a philosophical difference. I wouldn't say it goes so far as to be an argument unless I'm going through a stretch where I'm like not making any money, which has happened. So she married me in 2003. We had known each other for 10 years and I didn't really make any money in most of that time. So she knew me as a high school kid, as a college kid, and as a 20-something barely getting by. So she never expected me to find the level of success that I found. She just loved me for who I was for some reason. I still don't understand to this day. They're very lucky. Right, right. But when I did finally figure it out and start to have some success, which took about 15 years into my career. But when I did finally start making moves and putting things together and making some money, she immediately took over because she recognized that for me to keep doing what I was doing, she had to level up and she had to figure out like, well, all right, so now we're like making it, like what are people who are making it? What do they do with their money? What are the smart things? How, what kinds of accounts, who do they, you know, like what's the tax implications of getting into like writing a book versus getting a salary? Like she, there's a lot that she had to learn in order to like be part of this business that we're building. And to her credit, she really did. And I still haven't. So it's not a fight over money. The philosophical difference that we have is she sees all the expenditures going out. She sees everything that we're paying for. Like we're paying hundreds of dollars a week for the kids to be tutored. We're paying thousands of dollars in insurance. We're paying three car leases. Like it's just, it's endless. And she sees every dollar of it because she's handling that aspect. So, you know, she'll see me spending on other things and she'll be like, are you kidding me? Like, do you have any idea the outlays that are happening this time of year? Mm-hmm. And my philosophy is, all right, I guess I just have to make more money. And she's like, or, and hear me out, you could not add more work to your plate and we could just get smarter about living with what we're doing now. So that's the philosophical difference. My attitude is, all right, I guess I got to make more money. And her attitude is, that's not intelligent. That's crazy. You know, there's a smarter way to utilize the money we're already making. So it's, but it's not an argument. It's a push pull and, you know, we're figuring it out.
Yeah. As long as I've known you, it's been like one, I would almost say like one big project after another. And some of these projects are decades long, of course.
Yeah. I don't think I could keep going at this rate forever. But I think I'm in like a really important juncture for myself where the business just turned 10 years old. My blog just turned 15 years old. My first kid is going off to college.
So crazy, by the way.
I'm like right at this really interesting place where I have professional management running the business. And I have my kids now grown up to the point where they're more independent. And I'm like coming into this moment where I'm just going to have more time to build more things, be more creative. I'm going to have more support, more employees who are running, you know, various aspects of the company. And I can just really lean into what I've been doing for the last 10 or 15 years, but like in a major way. So I'm actually really excited about the next 10 years. And I'm feeling like extremely energetic and creative right now. All of that is to say, I don't want to talk about, you know, such and such is on sale at the supermarket. Like I, that's, to me, that's really tedious. I want to like really focus on what I'm doing. And it's hard. It's like hard to live with me for the kids too. Cause they know that sometimes I'm like somewhere else mentally, but it's not because I'm distracted because I'm stressed out. It's the opposite. I'm like really excited and fired up about the projects that we're working on. So that's kind of where you find me at this particular moment. And it's not a bad place to be. It's just, it's a lot.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And it is a lot. And I want to circle back to that in a minute, because I'm still curious about, because I think I was around shortly after the blog started. And I know I was around when there was, I think it was in an office with you and Barry once when there was some big decisions. Like you were just making some big decisions about.
What, should we get Chinese or Mexican for lunch? What was the big decision Barry and I were making?
Exactly. Barry was yelling about something. That's all I remember. Do you guys spend a lot of time at the executive level of the firm thinking about things you're worried about? Or are you more focused on the things you want to do?
No, most of our time is dealing with people. That's the whole business. Like once you figure out product market fit, like, all right, we actually have something people want. We could price it correctly. It's got some durability. Like it's going to make it through an economic cycle. Like once, and we're 10 years old. So once you figure that out, then it's just a question of, well, how do you scale this and make it bigger to grow the profits? And then once you're on that course, it's just all people. Everything is people. Hiring, firing, training, mentoring, conflict resolution. It's just people, 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 people. So that's the whole job now is people management. Once you get past 20 employees, that's all you do all day. So like if I have six or seven meetings in a day, They could be 5 minutes. They could be an hour long. Pretty much the entirety of that time is spent on people, not on technology or innovation, or it's really that. And that's fine. Like, that's what it should be. We're building a company that serves people. The company is being run by people. Like, it's not alien. Like, it's not other than how it should be. But I would just point out, like, talk to anybody that's got a company bigger than 20 employees. They'll tell you all day, people, people, people.
Just walk me through an experience you've had over the last 20 years building this thing where it hasn't worked. And you like this, because I feel the same way. Like, no, I'll just build more. And my wife says similar things, like, or we could do this too. And then sometimes I come home and I like take on the martyr role of like, I guess I just got to work more.
Yeah. Well, you're very much like me in that way. Because you always have a project and you always have a next thing.
Yeah.
So you and I are very similar. It's always what's next.
Yeah.
And that's not to say we don't finish what was previous.
Barely.
But it's never enough. So you and I we're very much the same in that respect. We've made mistakes like all the time. We're probably making a bunch right now. You just don't know when you're in the moment. Yeah. What we won't do is double down on mistakes. You make hiring mistakes. You make allocation mistakes. You make geographic mistakes, like physically, where should we do whatever. The thing is that the goal is to learn from the mistakes and not double down on them and recognize them faster and faster. And I actually think we've gotten better. We don't have like long lingering things that we're dealing with for years. Like, we just really don't seem to have those things in business. So we still make mistakes, but like it's not just Barry and I, it's Michael, it's Chris. And then there's a whole level of executives who run various departments, and we'll look at each other and we'll say, all right, this has to stop. We have to do something different. So I think we're as a firm, we're getting better at that. We're pretty good at that.
Do you ever go home and do the martyr thing? I'm curious now from my perspective, like where you're like, I guess I just have to work more.
It wouldn't matter. Nobody would care. They're all looking at their phones. They barely acknowledge me when I walk. That's not going to go anywhere. I'll tell you right now.
So have you tried it? Like, does that ever come with your wife? Like, how come the whole thing's on, I just got to work more? None of that. You're just like, nope, just go back to work.
First of all, I wouldn't trade places with my wife with what she's dealing with all day. She's dealing with two teenagers. They're my teenagers, so they're not exactly easygoing or quiet, or, you know, I would never trade with her. I think what she's doing might be more mentally exhausting, especially if I had to do it, or I probably would be terrible at it, is the other thing. So I don't walk in the house like, I just got off a plane and I just did this and I just did. Nobody wants to hear it. The other thing is, my kids follow my exploits via social media. And I'm at steakhouses and I'm on stage and I'm with celebrities and I'm at nightclubs. And when you're on social media, a lot of what you're doing is like showing the greatest hits.
Right.
And I think maybe to my detriment, I've given my family the impression that like it's one big party until I get home. And I've made it look easy. I guess maybe the way my parents made it look easy when I was growing up, I've made it look easy and cinematic. And of course, 99% of the time, it is neither of those things, but it's okay. I don't need any pats on the back or sympathy. Like, I'm very lucky. Most of the things that I do on a daily basis are things that I've chosen to do. I don't have a boss. No, I don't have somebody telling me what I have to do. So I never complain, because this was not always my life. And I recognize like how much autonomy I have. So if you see me struggling on a project or like working some crazy amount of hours or schlepping to, you know, a city on a red eye or whatever, I've made all the choices that led up to that. Like, I've of my own volition, it's all my decisions. So nobody feels bad for me and nobody should.
So good. That strikes me as uniquely, like, I want to say like the opposite of the woo-woo approach, you know, like you're just like, dig in, get the work done. Nobody wants to hear it. Is that a function of like where you grew up, who you are? Like, what is that?
Yeah. So we're Long Islanders. So people from Queens and Nassau County, like we're strivers. Like, we're outside of Manhattan. We're outside of the city, but we want in. We want our piece too. There's a mentality there's a grabbiness and like a, you know, you think you get on a commuter train, there's two seats left, 10 people get on. You either move and get that seat or you don't. There's a hustle. It's like ingrained in us. It's part of our DNA. Our parents and our grandparents moved out to Long Island from Brooklyn, Queens, and the Bronx. It's not like our ancestors were farmers on Long Island during George Washington times. So it's borough people who were never Manhattan borough people. It's outer borough strivers who have to fight for space, fresh air, respect, elbow their way onto a bus, like make their way into a company over the bridge or through the tunnel in Manhattan. Like that's the DNA of the place. So my neighbors, it's Russian Jews, it's Italians, it's Irish, it's Polish, people whose ancestors got here with nothing, built whatever they built in Queens and Brooklyn, like just fighting for every inch of dirt, and then eventually scraped together enough money to get to the suburbs, like to move into a proper house with a yard. And then like if you look at them funny or even think about, you know, sitting on the couch without the plastic covering on it, you're going to get it. Multiply that. So then you have another generation, and then that's us. So we're like the Gen X version of that thing that happened from 1900, let's say, to 1950 when the suburbs were built. Like we're the third generation, and we acted. So it's not always great. It's not always what other people around the world want to deal with, but it's undeniably and uniquely a Long Island way of being. And all four of the founders of the firm come from the same 20-mile radius. So
we'll be right back with more from 50 Fires.
Hey, it's Carl. You know what's hard for most of us? Talking money. That's what I'm talking about. Talking about money is hard for most of us, but there's somebody who it is not hard for. She's been doing it forever. Her name is Shauna Game. And if you've been enjoying the conversations I am having here at 50 Fires, I think you would love what Shauna's got going on at her podcast. The podcast is called Everyone's Talking Money. And just like 50 Fires, Shauna's goal with Everyone's Talking Money is to go beyond the spreadsheets and the calculators and the budgeting apps to talk about how our emotional relationship with money impacts our lives. With over 900 episodes, that's right, 900, there is an episode for any and every practical money question you have. Some of Shauna's recent episodes include retirement risks to avoid and credit card versus debit card. Which one should I use? You're going to love it. Subscribe to Everyone's Talking Money on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to 50 Fires. How are you and your wife talking about money with the kids differently than happened in your house?
So we're really not. Mm. They ask questions, we answer them. We give them honesty. How much is that car worth? How much is our house worth? We just tell them. We don't play games. But we're not like, so who knows what the mortgage interest rate is? Like there's a lot more that I think that they need to focus on right now. Mm. And I feel like they'll get to that when the time comes. We're super focused on getting them into the college of their choice, academically being able to get into these places that they want to go, and setting themselves up on a path so that they can have a career that they really like. Like that's the most important thing to my wife and I right now. And we will do anything to ensure that that happens. Tutors, extra help at school, driving them early, picking them up late. That's like to us, that's what this whole thing has been about. And maybe we'll rest once we've gotten them there and we'll have conversations with them about money and finance. But until then, it's just not going to be a focus.
Do you think your kids know what socioeconomic class they're in compared to like peers at school?
No. I don't. I think they're going to learn. They're going to get out into the world and be shocked. Look, we have spent a lot of time doing things that are charitable because we believe that involving them at this age is important. So, you know, one of the things that we've done, my daughter really took the lead on this eventually, We work with a local food bank called the Harry Chapin Food Bank, Long Island Cares. Amazing organization. Every Thanksgiving, we've mobilized the other kids in her age group and then for my son as well. They're in supermarkets. They're putting together meals for Thanksgiving. Big food drives, hundreds of bags at a time, raising thousands of dollars at a clip. Like, we've involved them a lot in that. So they understand that that is one socioeconomic reality that they do not personally have to endure, but they understand it exists. On the flip side, they're in summer camp. They, you know, they go to camp with people who land a helicopter on the soccer field for visiting day, and they chopper in from the Hamptons. And that's obviously not the life that my kids are living. So they've seen, you know, both ends of the spectrum, and they understand what's out there. So I think they have a pretty good idea, but they don't have tons of friends who are from all of these different socioeconomic strata. And I think that's what they're going to gain in their young adulthood. Like, they're going to come much closer to it than they would living where we live in our own homogenous kind of community. So I think they'll see a lot more once they're out in the world. They're really not out in the world right now. They're in school, or they're on the streets on their bikes, or they're in my home. So I don't think they've seen much.
Yeah, and I'm really struck, Josh, because it's super cool to me that you don't seem to be too worried about preemptively preparing them for that. You're like, look, we're focused on these things.
Yeah.
And just like me, they're going to get out and figure it out. Do I have that right?
Yeah. Not everyone agrees with that approach, but
I mean, I spend a lot of time in these conversations where people are just like, how do I teach my kids? And yeah, can we have a family meeting? And can we,
they don't listen. It doesn't matter. What am I going to, I love my kids. If I tell my daughter, you would love this movie, the actress that is your favorite actress is in it, and it's about this subject matter that's like the thing that you're so into, and if that's almost guaranteeing that she won't watch it, even 1 minute of it, would never even consider it. It's not a personality flaw. She's just a very typical teenage girl. Right. And if her dad tells her something is cool, it can't be cool. So my attitude is like, they're going to be curious. They're going to be interested in these things. When they are, I would love to tell them my thoughts on them. And that happens all the time. They'll ask a question. They'll hear something. They'll see something in the news. They'll have an assignment in school. And that's when I will do my teaching. But like, I'm not in search of like the perfect book to teach my kids about money, because they ain't going to read it. So I have all the things that I need to focus on. But I will absolutely take the time to explain things as they come up, like practically in our lives. And I do.
Yeah.
So when they ask for, hey, my son wants to go to a Knicks game, the cheapest tickets to go to a Knicks game are like $300 each. Like, it's just, it's outrageous. He doesn't understand why we can't go all season, like every night. Like, you know, why are we watching this on TV? We could be there in 45 minutes. Let's go. So like, I will use that as a time to like explain, you need to understand how many hours it would take me to make the money that this would cost. And then how many hours pre-tax versus how many hours post-tax. Well, what do you mean by tax, Dad? Okay, right. Now we're in a useful conversation where I can explain this stuff. So I wouldn't say I don't explain money to my kids. I would say like I try to naturally allow the topic to be broached, and then I'm ready with responses that I think are helpful.
Hey, it's me again. I don't know if you felt that, but I felt a little unmoored during this part of the conversation. And it made me wonder, like, what is my approach? You know, like, what approach have I taken with talking about money with the kids? Because what Josh is pointing to here, he actually does talk with his kids about money. He just lets it come up, and he's alert to it. That this is, I don't think Josh gives himself enough credit, because first he said, I don't talk about it. But what he's actually doing is looking for opportunities to talk about it. Because I can remember plenty of times where my kids may have made a comment about money and I just brushed it off. Like, hey, that's none of our business, or we don't talk about that. And what Josh is pointing to here is like actually looking, being alert for opportunities to talk about it. So I love that. And I just want to reinforce the idea too, that for me, talking about money with my kids and my spouse has been really hard because no one taught me how to do it. And so it's been clumsy. In fact, it still is. But I've made a commitment to not stop, right? And as a result, some of the most beautiful conversations about where we place our value and what's important to us, what's worth investing our time and our energy into, have happened because they started as a simple conversation about money. So all I'm going to suggest is that you keep trying, right? Look for opportunities to have conversations about money when they come up naturally, the way Josh is pointed to here. Well, tell me, we've like popped in and out of each other's lives over the last like 15 years. And the one constant has been being driven. What drives you? Like, what is that all about? What's the goal?
So it's not really money. I have like this huge chip on my shoulder. I think of myself like as an underdog who nobody believes in, and it pisses me off. And it's what I think is my fundamental, like me, of course I want to earn a living, and of course I want to have nice things, and I want to, you know, give my kids like opportunities, obviously, like everyone else on earth. So like the thing that's above and beyond that is like, I dare you to tell me that I can't do something. Like, I'd love to see you tell me what I'm not able to do. And then I just do it over and over and over again. And that's the motor. I don't know. Is that bad? Is it good? Is it mentally healthy? Is it psychotic? I don't know. But that's the main thing, is just like being picked last for every sport, like being talked to last by the girls, being like not expected to, you know, make it on Wall Street, like not being able to get a job at Goldman Sachs or Merrill Lynch, like just one, you know, one like rejection after another. And like my goal is, by the time I'm done, is to just tell everyone I have more financial success, more happiness, like more professional success, like everything that I want for myself. Not the wealthiest, not like the CEO of Merrill Lynch. Like, that's not what I want. Like, I will have what I want. And that's really like the main thing. And what I want is exactly what I have now. So I should be like calming down. Like, I my kids are healthy and happy. I'm with my high school sweetheart. She loves me for whatever reason. I have a great group of friends. I love the town I live in. We're 2 minutes from the beach. You know, I have a firm filled with people who came there because they're fans of the blog and the podcast. Like, I'm surrounded by clients that want to do business with us because they believe in us. Like, I have it. I have it all. There's nothing like fundamentally that I don't have that I still need, but I have that chip on my shoulder of people. Like, I just know that there are people that like think this is it. This is all I could do. And so I don't know. Is it a sickness? Is it healthy? I don't know. What do you think? You interview people for a living. What's wrong with me?
Are you? Well, look, first of all, it's just amazing to hear, because we've talked a little bit about this over the years, and I've never heard you say it so clearly. Are you like I'm curious about this, because I had the same kind of experience. And again, I don't know if this is like a mountains of Utah, Long Island thing, but like, I got told I would never amount to anything, right? My parents were divorced when I was 8. I should be in prison statistically. Yeah. You know, the things I did in high school and just out of high school. Like,
did people tell you, or did you just have a feeling that that's how people thought about you?
Well,
or did people like explicitly tell you you're not going to amount to anything?
Actually, what they told me was you could amount to a lot if you just focus.
Okay. So that's a good message though.
Yeah. I mean, it, other than the, like, I have never been able to focus problem, and that's taken me 20 years to figure out, like, I could build a business around not focusing. You know what I mean? Like, that's an okay problem.
So nobody ever said to me, you won't amount to anything. Like, again, I didn't come from the trenches of class warfare. Like, I came from like middle or upper middle class. Nobody ever said like, you'll never amount. In fact, teachers would often say exactly like what you heard, like, if this kid ever decides to apply his abilities, like, it's going to be amazing, but he just won't. Nobody ever said that I would never amount to something. It's actually, for me, it's worse. It's people have thought and said things that made me understand that they've thought they were better than me. Like, people have acted in such a way around me, like, you wouldn't understand, or you'll never be where I am, or like, oh, no, no, this is for me. It's not for you. That's really the thing. Like, if somebody ever said, you'll never amount to, I'd probably would have laughed in their face. Because, again, my response would have been, oh, yeah, watch this. So it's not really that. It's more like, oh, really? You think you're smarter than me? You think you're more talented? You think you'll work harder than me? Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Watch this. Like, that's really the – and I don't know why I measure myself against other people's expectations, but I do really enjoy people being like, that guy? Like, I like evoking that reaction in people. I definitely get some satisfaction out of that. Not like in a snarky way, but just, yeah this guy. You know?
Yeah. If that's what drives you, will there ever be enough?
No. No. But I don't hate what I'm doing, so it's
right,
fine,
right?
Right? Like,
right.
I'm not like, oh, I can't take it anymore. Look, I'm very lucky. A lot of the hard work that gets done out of view, you know, people think like you wake up and it's like, oh, I run this firm and I'm blogging. It is so not like that.
Right.
We have amazing people who are really dedicated to what they're doing at the company. And that's the only reason Barry and I can be Barry and I, is that there are people who are great at what they do and really care. And my employees rely on them. My clients rely on them. We have like really great people. So most of what I'm doing, I like doing. So it's not like, will there ever be enough? It's not, I don't make millions of dollars a year. So that it's not money. It's not enough like, oh, I don't have enough material thing. I am enjoying myself. You could tell. Like when you see me at an event and I'm surrounded by people who are there because they're interested in hearing what I have to say, I'm enjoying it. It's not drudgery. I want to do it. So again, every situation I find myself in, back to what I said before, is like, oh, this is the culmination of all of these choices that I made leading up to this. Like, these are my choices.
So interesting.
I talked you into a corner.
No.
I bet you thought it would never happen.
No, there's like seven different directions I want to go. You see a lot. You see a lot of the way people interact with money.
Yeah.
More than probably anybody. And I'm not talking about investing here. What's the one thing you're just like, my gosh, people are making the same mistake over and over and over about their relationship with money?
I think the biggest challenge for financial advisors in the 21st century is to get it through to clients that they're probably not going to outlive their money and that they have to learn how to spend and be happy spending.
Mm.
You know, we've done a really good job in this country. Save, 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 save. It worked. Like we have 4,000 households and most of them have gotten the message decades ago and they have saved. The thing is, it's really hard to, you do that for 50 years and then you turn 70 and your financial advisor is like, okay, now spend. And they can't.
Right.
They can't do it. Or they're asking for permission, or they need to be talked into taking a first class flight. Like, I've never flown first class before. Okay, do it now. You're going to visit, your kids are in London. Do a first class flight. You have millions of dollars that you're not going to spend it. This is this is the life that you're living right now. Live it the way you deserve to live it. You've worked, you've sacrificed, you've saved, you've put off, you've delayed gratification. You've done all of the things that you were told to do. Buy the first class ticket. What are we even talking about? Right. Mm. So that's a lot of our work. And I never thought it would be that way. Like, I always thought financial advisors like, oh, you have this 4% withdrawal rule and don't let your clients overspend. They will never spend this money.
Yeah.
They will literally never spend this. They can't. There would have to be like two 1929s in a row in order for them to be in a situation where they're about to spend down their whole portfolio. So in that world, and it's not a negative, it's great. In that world, you have two choices or some combination of the two. Choice one is get comfortable spending your own money and living your life or giving it to people and allowing them to enjoy it while you're alive to see it, right? Be more ambitious with your goals. Or let's cut back on the amount of risk we're taking. Maybe we don't need as much exposure to stocks and venture capital and private equity and all these things. If our spending is low and poised to remain low, why are we taking all this risk to grow the portfolio? So for most clients, talking to one of our financial planners, the right answer is probably somewhere in between those two things. Spend a little bit more and take a little bit less risk when they're in these surplus situations. And they are in these surplus situations, even with current rate of inflation. Like, even if there's a change in the tax code, like, they're still going to be fine. So one of our primary things that we see people making mistakes with is actually the opposite of what you'd think. They are too good at saving, not good enough at enjoying.
Is there something that you're delaying? If your financial planner sat you down and said, hey, your financial advisor sat you down and said, Josh, it's time to do the thing. Is there a thing?
I'm doing the thing. It's not the only thing I ever want to do, but it's the thing right now. And, you know, it takes time and it takes money. And those are the resources that I have that I'm using. And this is what I want. So I don't think that I'm in that situation. But we do talk to people who are very specifically in that situation. They say things like, well, someday when I can afford whatever, the fishing boat. It's like,
do you think
that's going to be more fun at 80 than it is at 65? Because it definitely won't be, you know?
Right. I've been fascinated by that too. Let me just tell you an experience I've been having lately, and I'm curious if it resonates with you. People come to Park City, where I live, and they've read one of the columns or the book. They've heard me talk somewhere, and they send an email, and they say, hey, I'm going to be in Park City for vacation. I'd love to grab coffee. And we meet, and let me set another stage. I get done speaking someplace. In the hall, somebody comes up to me, and it's always this cohort, 45 to 55-year-old, maybe a little younger, 40 to 55-year-old. So whether it's in the coffee shop or at the conference, they look around to make sure nobody's listening. And they say, hey, I've done it. You know what I mean? Like, I've sort of did the thing. I built the business. I sold it for a bunch of money. I make $1 million. Like, whatever it is, I'm successful, quote unquote, based on everybody else's metrics. And then they look around again to make sure nobody's listening. And they say, like, is this all there is? Right? Like, is this what it's for?
What do you say?
Well, I keep getting, like, it feels to me a lot like the Stephen Covey problem, to paraphrase. Like, you spent your whole life climbing a ladder only to find out it's leaning against the wrong wall. Are you having those conversations?
No, I know exactly what I want. Like, yeah. I know. I want to be in the sun all year.
What does that mean? Like, the actual sun?
Yeah. Like, I want my kids to have careers, and I want to have a home outside of New York where it's sunny.
Where is that?
Florida.
Florida.
Big shocker. So yeah. I want to be there in the winter. I want to be here in the summer. And I want my kids to have careers and find happiness and marry well and have kids. And I know what I want. Like, I'm not going to get there and be like, is this it? I don't have existential, like, anxiety.
Yeah.
If I get there, I'll say, like, all right, this whole thing was for something. So I got to piss off a lot of people who thought they were better than me, and I'm in the sun. Like, that's it. That's what I want. So
we got a t-shirt. Yeah. Last question. Your youngest is 15?
14. Yeah.
14. Let's just pretend like I'm still doing this 20 years from now.
Okay.
And he comes on, and I ask him about, like, what money means to him. And I ask him some of these same, what would you hope he would say about what money means to him?
Well, I hope he would see it the same way I do, which is that the money represents options. Money in and of itself obviously has no meaning. It's the freedom and the choices that you get when you have it. That's all it is. So I think they see that and they understand that. When we go on vacation and we can either eat, you know, we could eat at a Chipotle, or we could go eat at a sushi restaurant, and we get to choose. And they understand that not everybody gets to choose. So I think they get it. But yeah, that would, if that's what my kid says to you 20 years from now, I learned from my dad that the money doesn't matter. It's the options that the money gives you that's important. Like, for me, that would be what I would want him to understand.
Amen, brother. That's all I've got.
So I guess we'll find out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we'll find out. Well, that was fun. I know many of you who are listening to this show have heard Josh speak or talk on his podcast probably hundreds of times. I have too. And what was so fun about this conversation is I've known Josh a very long time, and I learned something I'd never heard before. I mean, how great is that story about the bills being stolen at summer camp? Something that Josh hasn't thought of for 35 years. But as soon as he was asked, it only took a second. Like, there was no hesitation. Often when I ask this question, like, what's your earliest memory? People will say, oh, let me think about that. That's Josh, just boom, right in. And that's been one of the surprising things for me about the show. It shouldn't have surprised me, given the work I've done as a financial planner for years. But it doesn't take much to have a really great conversation about money. All it takes is a decent question. And so, as we wrap this show up, the one thing I would just encourage you, we all have money stories. I am convinced that we have to have more meaningful conversations about money. I don't know if you know, but the way we feel about money doesn't seem to be getting better. The word people use most often is anxious or scared, and that doesn't seem to be getting better. And I only know one way it's going to get better. It's actually a precondition of it getting better, is that we learn how to talk about it. So it was so fun to have a conversation with Josh. And in fact, this reminded me of what I learned through my conversation with my wife on a prior episode that you may want to go back and listen to. I learned stuff. We've been married 28 years. I learned stuff that I didn't know simply because I took the time to ask on the show. So with that, my friends, join me in this collective goal. Let's use 50 Fires to spark a million conversations a month with the people that we love. Meaningful conversations about money, so we can change the way we feel about it. Cheers. 50 Fires is a production of Blind Nil Audio in association with The Roost. If you find this show valuable, and I sure hope you do, please share it with a friend and leave a 6 or 7 or maybe even 8-star review over on Apple Podcasts. It's crazy how much that helps the show get introduced to more people. I'm looking forward to our next conversation around the fire. Cheers, my friends.
The views, information, or opinions expressed in this series are solely those of the individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of Chip and Joanna Gaines, Blind Nil Audio, nor Magnolia.